I did this work in collaboration with my colleague Arik and my supervisors Siddharth and Mahesh. Okay, so what do we mean by computer hardware? Well, we mean that to be digital integrated circuits. Digital integrated circuits are the realization of digital logic, and as I show by this picture, they can be very complex and dense, as many ICs can have millions, if not billions, of transistors and wires. So the manufacturing process for ICs first starts by describing the functionality in a hardware descriptive language, HDL. This language might look like C to you. And from HDL, we translate it into a netlist using a thin synthesis process, which represents a symbolic circuit where we have Boolean gates connected with wires. Now this circuit is manufactured into a physical IC that can be installed into your electronics. Okay, for economic reasons, ICs are often outsourced to an external foundry, and this is at a trade-off of trust, because we do not have control over this foundry, and it only takes one malicious employee in that foundry to modify the circuit, and all subsequent ICs are now infected with this bug. This is a real threat, as a recent news story shows a scare of a security backdoor found in a US military chip. So let me go over a couple examples, attack examples, found in literature. So the first is privilege escalation. And this is where the adversary would modify the computer hardware to allow him access to super user privilege. As an example. Another type is leaking private information, where the adversary would modify, say for example, an encryption-decryption circuit to leak either the private key or the plain text. And we work on a premise that to successfully attack a circuit, the adversary must first uniquely identify at least one gate in that circuit to attack. And here I show a netlist responsible for super user privilege. And for our adversary to make the privilege escalation attack, he would first want to identify the bit responsible for raising his privilege to super user. This is the gate responsible. Okay, so let me walk you through a simple example that has been maliciously modified. This is a full adder netlist, and it has three inputs and two outputs. This gate, labeled M, has been maliciously inserted, and it uses an additional input to trigger the attack. Now, under this state of inputs, the Cout bit is zero, but when the trigger is activated, the Cout bit is flipped, and thus the attack is successful. Okay, so how can we address this threat? We propose circuit obfuscation, and that is where we choose a set of wires in the netlist to hide from the adversary. This is shown on the bottom right diagram for the obfuscated netlist, where the hidden wires are gray and not visible to the adversary. Now, if the adversary wants to attack gate 2, he has two choices that he cannot distinguish between. It could either be gate V or gate W. And this is the level of confusion that is the measure of our security. Now also note that the labeling of the obfuscated netlist is different than the original netlist. This is by necessity, but it will also become apparent how this naturally happens in our process. Okay, 3D IC technology will allow us to obfuscate the circuit. Now a 3D IC divides a circuit into two or more tiers that are stacked together and connected via bond points. We propose to use only two tiers, where the top tier will only consist of wires that we will hide from the adversary. And this is called the hidden tier, where the bottom tier will contain all of the gates and the remaining set of wires. And we call this the obfuscated tier. Now, since the top tier only consists of wires, it is actually quite a bit less expensive to manufacture. And so now we can actually do this in-house in a trusted manner. This technology is commercially used and is normally employed to overcome scalability issues, but for this talk, we propose a use for security. And here I show our process for securing a circuit using 3D IC technology. So first we start with our original netlist, and we choose a set of wires to hide. This will partition the netlist into two, where we have a hidden netlist and an obfuscated netlist. And then the next step is to a place and route step, where we determine the physical location of the gates on the chip surface and the wire path between those gates. Now this step has to be trusted, as we do not want the adversary to have access to our hidden wires or the location of the gates on the chip surface. Now, of course, the hidden circuit has to be manufactured in a trusted facility, but the obfuscated circuit can be outsourced to an untrusted facility. The final step is to stack the two tiers together for the final product. Okay, so let me summarize our attack model. So we have our original netlist, and this has an equivalent graph representation shown as G. And for the netlist, every gate in the netlist is represented by a vertex in G. And the gate types, such as ANDs or NOTs, are represented by vertex colors in the gate, in the graph. The connections between gates in the netlist are represented by edges in the graph. Okay, so now the adversary will only see this small little diagram on the bottom right, the obfuscated circuit. And notice that there are no labels on the obfuscated circuit. It's just a physical representation of the circuit. But he can reverse engineer this to get a netlist shown here and apply an arbitrary set of labels. And of course, this also has an equivalent graph representation, which we call H. Now, it is very likely that the adversary has some kind of inkling as to what the circuit functionality is used for, but we assume a stronger adversary to have full knowledge of the original netlist and thus have full knowledge of the graph G. So, continuing in the attacker's shoes, he receives input graphs G and H. And the first thing he would want to do to attack the circuit is figure out the functionality of one of the gates or vertices in this graph H. So this is accomplished by finding subgraph isomorphisms. And here I show all four subgraph isomorphisms for our example. Now, if the adversary had to correctly identify each vertex in this graph, then this would be a proper measure of security for this attack. But recall from our premise that the adversary only has to attack one gate. So let me introduce our notion of security for one gate, or vertex. A vertex V in H is K secure if there exists at least K subgraph isomorphisms, each of which maps V to its distinct vertex in G. And for our example, our vertex W we see can map to either vertex 2 or vertex 4 in G, and so we have a security of 2. And similarly, vertex V, U, and X also have a security of 2. But we notice that vertex Y has a unique mapping, only has one possible mapping, and so it only has a security of 1. This means that the adversary can exactly identify which gate this will correspond to, and so this gate has no security. So now let me introduce our notion of security for a circuit. An obfuscated graph or circuit H is K secure if every vertex or gate in H is K-secure. And as I just pointed out, we have a vertex in H that is only one secure. So this graph is only one secure. Even though we have other vertices in H that have more security, we take the conservative approach to defining this, our notion. Okay, so given graphs G and H, we have proven in our paper that to decide K-security, to decide if they are K-secure, it is an NP-complete problem. And what this means is that we don't expect there to be an efficient algorithm to solve our problem. So we investigate two approaches where we reduce our problem to two other NP-complete problems. And the first approach we take is to reduce it to subgraph isomorphism. Now, this is a natural approach since our problem is closely related to subgraph isomorphism. And we use a specialized subgraph isomorphism solver, the VF2 solver. The other approach we take is to reduce our problem to SAT and use the MiniSAT solver, which is also specialized for SAT. Here I show the comparison of these two approaches by measuring the average time with respect to the graph size. And quite surprisingly, the reduction to SAT approach outperforms the reduction to subgraph isomorphism by about three orders of magnitude. Okay, so of course security doesn't come for free, and in fact we incur a cost for every wire that we try and hide. So we aim to explore this cost versus security trade-off by employing a greedy approach. The first step in this approach is to construct an obfuscated graph with no edges. Now, note this is the maximum cost, but it also has the maximum security. Where if I choose a vertex in H of a specific color, that will map to any vertex in G of that exact same color. So the next step is to pick an edge from G and add it to H. But we're going to do this in a greedy manner where we maximize security for every edge we choose. We're going to repeat this process until we come to a security of 1. And here are the results for comparing security versus cost. I'm comparing our greedy approach to a random approach where the graph for the random has been the edges have been chosen at random. So the curves in this graph represent the average of all runs, where the dotted lines represent the maximum and minimum over all runs. An interesting thing to note is that for the greedy approach on this circuit, we need to hide at least 50% of the wires to gain any security, compared to the random approach that has to hide 75% of the wires. Another thing to note is that when we remove all of the edges, or hide all of the edges in the obfuscated graph, we obtain a security of 48. And this corresponds to a vertex color that only appears 48 times in our graph. And lastly, I want to point out these plateaus in the greedy approach. This corresponds to a constant security level for different costs. So there would be no reason to choose the higher cost when we can just go with the lower cost. Okay, so we've obtained security for our graph. And now I want to ensure that the rest of the fabrication process does not compromise our security. So let me first explain how the rest of the process is done for an unsecure circuit. So we feed the netlist into a CAD tool that will decide the placement of gates on the chip surface. And this placement is done in such a manner to minimize the average wire length in that circuit. Finally, the CAD tool will figure out a routing for all these wires on the physical chip. Now, we do not want this optimization step of minimizing the average wire length to compromise the knowledge or reveal any knowledge about our hidden wires. So we propose to feed the CAD tool the same information that the adversary is privy to, namely the obfuscated netlist. And so the CAD tool will optimize all of the wires in the netlist by placing the gates in an appropriate place on the chip surface. But then we're going to need the full netlist fed into the CAD tool to route all of the wires. So these are pictures comparing these two different processes. Here on the left, I show an unsecure circuit. And on the right, I show the two tiers of our secure circuit. Now, it's difficult to see, but the tiny boxes in the circuit represent gates, while the red and green lines represent wires. And the larger fat blue and red lines represent power bus. So the interesting thing to note here is that the hidden tier wires seem to be much longer than the unsecure circuit wires. And this is because the CAD tool had no input to optimize these. And this is a good thing. We did this on purpose. The other thing to note is that the obfuscated tier only has a subset of the wires. And so this is a reflects the amount of information that the adversary has access to. Okay, so let's analyze the wire length distribution of these circuits and tiers. So here I show the unsecure circuit in red. And we can see that about 70% of the wires have been optimized to be less than 8 microns. Another thing to note is that no wires are optimized, no wire lengths in the unsecure circuit are longer than 50 microns. So this is, if we were to use this process for our secure chip, then an attacker could infer information about any gate that is further than 50 microns apart to be not connected. Now this is exactly the information that we do not want the adversary to have, and this is why we employ layout randomization. So we can see in the hidden wires that there are wire lengths longer than 50 microns. And so the adversary cannot infer this information. We can also see that the average wire length is quite a bit higher than the unsecure version, and that the distribution of wire lengths are quite a bit wider. Now this is exactly the distribution that we would expect if the gates were randomly placed on the chip surface. And we ran a chi-squared test to see if there was any statistical significant differences between our distribution and a randomly placed gate location on the chip. And we didn't find any. The last thing to note is that the obfuscated circuit, the CAD tool was able to minimize most of the wires to be less than 8 microns. Okay, so what does it mean to have longer wire lengths in your circuit? Well, it means that we're going to pay more in power and we're going to incur a performance hit in terms of delay. So here I measure the ratio of power and delay with respect to the unsecure circuit, and I plot that over different security levels. So the first thing to note is that to obtain any security in a circuit, we have to pay a high initial cost. Specifically, we're paying 1.5 times the amount of power and 1.7 times the amount of delay. Now, subsequent levels of security only incur incremental costs in both power and delay. Okay, so now I'm going to walk you through our DES case study. DES is commercially used, and we obtained a circuit from the OpenCores library that has more than 35,000 gates. DES has also been shown to have a fault injection vulnerability. Specifically, if we were to inject faults on the least significant bit of the 14th round, then after a number of trials, we could reconstruct the private key. So how can we secure this circuit with the method that we have just learned about? Well, I would suggest removing all of the wires to all of the rounds. And now we have 16 identical circuits that are not connected. And if we only care about the security of the rounds, we now have a 16 secure circuit. And we only had to lift 13% of the wires. But I further lift more wires to obtain a 64 secure circuit. But recall that 64 secure circuit is a lower bound on the security of any gate in that circuit. And further investigation shows for the least significant bit of the 14th round, it's actually 255 secure. So the adversary now has a choice. He can choose to attack one out of those 255 possible gates. But if he did that, he would risk a pretty high chance of failure, of guessing the wrong gate. Or he can decide to attack all 255 gates to make sure that his attack was not for nothing. But of course, attacking 255 gates is going to take at least 250 times the amount of resources. But we can't attack all 255 gates simultaneously, so we have to add additional circuitry to choose which gate we're going to attack. And this, as we show, inflates the attack size to more than 420 times the area compared to attacking one gate. Now, this makes it more difficult to hide this attack in the unused area of the chip. And so it also makes it more easy for the defender to find this attack. Okay. So what have we forced the adversary to do? We forced them to roll the dice and attack one out of K gates and risk failure, or he can attack all of the gates, use more resources, and risk detection. So, here is some related work and references. The top reference refers to K-anonymity, and K-anonymity uses a similar approach for social networks. Okay, thank you for your time.
I'm Cédric Fournet from Microsoft Research. I'm wondering about adaptive attacks when there are several batches that are being constructed. Well, the adversary can test the first batch to attack the next batch. Or do you need to randomize every time you produce a new batch of
chips? Yes. So we address this in our paper, and we propose that you have to do this in batches. So you either do a full run and then sell the product, or if you want to do multiple runs, you have to resecure the circuit every time.
Cynthia Sturton, UNC. So it looks like this does incur some overhead, right, in terms of wire length and delay and everything. Do you have any thoughts on what would be the best use case for this technology?
What would be the best use case?
Yeah, so how could a company leverage this so that they're not hit with this high overhead on their entire circuit?
So for the DS example, you could choose a subset of the circuit that you're only interested in securing. And so then you would minimize the amount of overhead. But no, I mean, we do have to pay the cost for this, so yeah.
Hello, Kevin Fu, University of Michigan. I've got two questions, one sort of benefit, one a risk. On the risk side, I'm curious about the actual physical cost. If someone were manufacturing this, do you have any intuition on what, does it actually make a difference in the physical cost, or is it in the noise? And then the other related question is, in terms of reliability, does it change the reliability, or can you actually ride some other cost that the manufacturer is paying anyway to actually implement this?
So the physical costs are referring to the manufacturing costs?
Correct.
Okay. So there is a high initial cost of just paying for a 3D circuit compared to a non-3D circuit. And then as we hide more and more wires, we're going to need more surface area to allow for the bond points for the wires to be...
And the viaduct, the vias? Or?
Yeah, they're bond points because the vias could possibly go through the substrate for the logic. Mm-hmm. But... Yes, so those cost a little more, but really, if we just, it's going to be the area of the chip that is going to cost us more. So the more wires we need to hide, the more bond points we need, which takes up more area. And we might not actually be using the whole area of the chip for logic.
And what about, how many chips do use this 3D technology or are likely to, so that you're able to sort of get that cost for free?
How many chips already use that?
Yeah, right. Will.
Might.
You can pick any number.
Yeah. I don't know that.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks.
Hi. Thanks for the interesting presentation. I think this is related to the first question. Since multiple dies are made out of the single wafer,
yes.
The attacker can, you know, distribute possible, you know, attack points.
Okay.
Onto the, you know, multiple dies on a single wafer. That's going to enable like one out of two or three wafers.
Sure.
For the 255 attack points case. And how do you evaluate the cost of the attack and the outcome of the successful attacks on the product?
Okay, so I mean that's a good point. So a die might have four identical circuits, and you can mount four different attacks. If you assume this, then you could just require four times the amount of security in your circuit. So, because if you only had four, then that means he could mount all four attacks, and at least 25% of the circuits would have a successful attack. So that's a good point.
I guess my question is kind of related to his, and I'm not knowledgeable in this field, so forgive me if it's silly. When you say the attacker has a 1 to 200-something chance of attack, is it all or nothing, or he can choose to attack different points on different outcome? So does it mean that in a batch, 1 out of 200 can be successful, or it's like it's a whole batch?
Yes, yeah, so this isn't something that I made very clear, but a hardware attack requires a lot of upfront work. And this is usually done once because you have a physical die that just keeps printing these circuits. So nominally, you're only really going to have one chance to modify this die. So you're not going to be able to modify the die for every circuit that is printed. You're going to modify the die once for every batch that is printed.
Well, that's why I say I'm not knowledgeable.
No, that's fine. But does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay,